I was told that additions were to be made to the Dalai Lama's garden as well, and if my work was found satisfactory, I might be employed there. I set to work at once with the utmost zeal. They placed a number of men under my orders, and we soon got things moving. I now had no time for the private lessons in English and mathematics that I was giving to some young nobles. Suddenly, just as I was beginning to feel sure of our position in view of the powerful protection we now enjoyed, I had a fearful shock. One morning we received a visit from Mr. Kayabub, a high official at the Foreign Ministry and the last of the four Tibetans who had been educated at Rugby many years ago. He was clearly upset by his mission. After many apologies and expressions of regret, he told us that the English doctor had now certified that I was fit to travel and that the government expected us to depart at once. In confirmation, he showed us the certificate, which stated that although I was not completely cured, I could travel without endangering my life. This was a stunning and unexpected blow to Orf Snater and me. We pulled ourselves together and endeavored politely and calmly to present our side of the question. We explained that my illness might recur at any moment. What would I do if, in the middle of an arduous journey, I found I could not move a step farther? Moreover, the hot season in India had just begun. No one who had been living for so long in the healthy highland air of Tibet could endure transition without prejudice to his health. And what was to happen to the tasks with which we had been charged by the highest authorities, and which we felt bound to carry to completion? We promised to submit another petition to the government. From this day forth we heard never a word more about an order of expulsion, though for a while we lived in daily expectation of it. In the meantime, we had come to feel at home in Lhasa, and the people had got used to us. We received no more visits from curious people, only from friends. The British legation seemed convinced that we were not dangerous, for though Delhi had asked for our surrender, the point was not pressed. The Tibetan authorities assured us that we were not considered undesirable. We were now earning so much that we were no longer dependent on Zarong's hospitality. We made many friends during the course of our work, and time passed very quickly. The only thing for which we hankered was letters from home. We had now been over 2 years without news. Still, we comforted ourselves with the thought that our life was very tolerable and that we had many reasons for satisfaction. We had a good roof over our heads and were no longer struggling to exist. We did not miss the appliances of Western civilization. Europe with its life of turmoil seemed far away. Often as we sat and listened to the radio bringing reports from our country, we shook our heads at the depressing news. There seemed no inducement to go home. Life in Lhasa. All my previous experiences were put in the shade by the first official party I attended at the home of the parents of the Dalai Lama. It was by chance that I was there. I was working in the garden, where I had some new plots to lay out, when the Holy Mother sent for me and told me to leave my work for the day and join her guests. With some embarrassment I joined the brilliant throng in the reception room. Some 30 nobles were gathered there, all in their finest robes, and the scene was one of dignified splendor. The reception was to celebrate the birth of our hostess's youngest son, born 3 days before. I haltingly stammered my congratulations and offered a white scarf that I had managed to borrow. The Holy Mother smiled graciously. It was wonderful to see her walking unconcernedly about the room and entertaining her guests. The women here recover from their confinements with miraculous speed, and make very little fuss about childbirth. No doctors are called in, but the women help one another. Every woman is proud to have a lot of healthy children. The mother invariably nurses her own children and sometimes goes on suckling them for 3 or 4 years. When a child is born in a noble family, the infant at once gets a special nursemaid, who must never leave it day or night. Great celebrations follow the birth of a child, but there is nothing like our baptismal ceremony, and there are no godfathers. Before giving the infant its name, or rather names, as every child has several, the parents consult a lama, who decides what the infant shall be called only after studying the astrological aspects of the case. If the child subsequently suffers a serious illness, it is usual to give him fresher names. One of my grown-up friends once changed his name after an attack of dysentery, to my perpetual confusion. At the celebration of the birth of the Dalai Lama's little brother, we were entertained to a Lakullan feast, at which we sat on cushions at little tables in due order of precedence. For 2 consecutive hours the servants served course after course, I counted 40, but that was not the end. To eat through such a dinner required special training. I must be excused from mentioning all the delicacies that were offered to us, but I remember that they included all sorts of Indian spiced dishes and ended up with soup of noodles. For drinks we had, among other things, beer, whiskey, and port. By the end of the repast, many of the guests were tipsy, but that is no disgrace in Tibet, it contributes to the general merriment. The party broke up soon after the banquet. Horses and servants provided by the host waited outside to take the guests home. Invitations to other parties were launched indiscriminately, and it needed a discerning ear to distinguish between those that were meant seriously and those that were just a form of politeness. Orfsnater and I were often invited to this house, and I was soon on terms of cordial friendship with Lobsang Samten. This attractive youth was just entering upon his career as a monk. As the brother of the Dalai Lama, he had brilliant prospects. One day he was to play a great part as the intermediary between his brother and the government. But the burden of a great position was already beginning to weigh him down. He could not choose his acquaintances freely. Whatever he did and wherever he went, all sorts of inferences were drawn. When he called on a high functionary on some official occasion, his entry into the room caused an awestruck silence and everyone, even cabinet ministers, rose from their seats to show respect to the brother of the god king. All this might have turned a young man's head, but Lobsang Samten never lost his modest demeanor. He often talked to me about his young brother who lived a lonely life in the Pokhara. I had already noticed that all the guests at parties hid themselves when the figure of the Dalai Lama appeared walking on the flat roof of the palace. Lobsang gave me a rather touching explanation of this. The young god king possessed a number of excellent telescopes and field glasses, and it amused him to watch the life and doings of his subjects in the town. For him, the Potala was a golden prison. He spent many hours daily praying and studying in the dark palace rooms. He had little free time and few pleasures. When the guests at a merry party felt themselves being looked at, they vanished as soon as possible from the field of vision. They did not want to sadden the heart of the young ruler, who could never hope to enjoy such distractions. Lobsang Samten was his only friend and confidant, and had access to him at all times. He served as the link between him and the outer world and had to tell his brother everything that was going on. I learned from Lobsang that he was much interested in our activities and that he had often watched me through his telescope as I worked in the garden. He also told me that his brother was much looking forward to moving into his summer residence at Norbulinka. The fine weather had come, and he felt himself cramped in the Potala and longed to be able to take exercise out of doors. Now the season of sandstorms was over, and the beech trees were in blossom on the neighboring peaks. The last remnants of the snow shone blindly white in the warm sunshine, giving that peculiar charm to the springtime that I remembered in our mountain scenery at home. One day the summer season was officially declared to have begun, and summer clothes might be worn. One had no right to leave off one's furs when one wanted to. Every year, after considerations of the omens, a day was fixed on which the nobles and monks put on summer dress. The weather might have already been very warm, or snowstorms might follow. That did not matter. Summer dress must be worn from that date only. The same thing happens in autumn, when winter dress is officially resumed. I continually used to hear complaints that the changeover had come too soon or too late and that people were stifling or half frozen. The change of clothing is accompanied by a ceremony that lasts for hours. Servants bring new clothes bound up in bundles on their backs. The monks have an easier passage. They merely change their fur-brimmed hats for plate-shaped papier-mâché headdress. The whole appearance of the town is changed when everyone suddenly appears in new clothes. There is, however, one other occasion for a change of costume, and that is when the whole official world accompanies the Dalai Lama in a gorgeous procession to the summer garden. Ofsnator and I looked forward to watching it. We felt that we might get a close-up view of the living Buddha. It was a glorious summer day, and the whole town moved out through the western gate along the two-mile stretch that separates the Potala and the Norbulinka palaces. It was quite a job finding room to walk without being trodden on. I was sorry I had no camera to take pictures of the variegated crowds. Of course, only a color film would do it justice. This was a day of rejoicing for everyone, the opening day of summer, and I was glad for the boy who was going to exchange his gloomy prison for a lovely summer garden. He had little enough sunshine in his life. Splendid and imposing as the Potala Palace is externally, it is miserably dark and uncomfortable as a dwelling place. It is probable that all the god kings were glad to get away from it as soon as possible, for the summer garden residence of Norbulinka was planned as long ago as the reign of the 7th Dalai Lama, but completed only by the 13th. The latter monarch was a great reformer and at the same time a man of modern ideas. He actually imported for his own use 3 automobiles. These were taken to pieces at the frontier and carried by coolies and yaks over the mountains to the capital, where an Indian-trained mechanic reassembled them. This man was then appointed as chauffeur to His Majesty. He often used to talk to me sadly about his 3 cars, which now stood idle, but not unguarded, in a shed. They were 2 Austins and a Dodge. For a short while, they had been the sensation of Tibet, and now they mourn for their dead lord and rusted in honorable decay. The story of how the 13th Dalai Lama used his automobiles to escape from his winter prison still provokes laughter. In the autumn he used to return with pomp and circumstance to the Potala, but as soon as the crowds were out of the way, he would get into one of the cars and drive back to Norbulinka. We heard the blare of trumpets and trombones. The procession approached. The murmurs of the crowd were hushed, and a reverent silence reigned, for the head of the column was in sight. A host of serving monks formed the vanguard. With them they carried the god king's personal effects done up in bundles, each bundle wrapped in a yellow silk cloth. Yellow is the color of the reformed Lamaistic church, which is also known as the Yellow Church. An old legend tells why this color was chosen. Tsongkhapa, the great reformer of Buddhism in Tibet, was standing on the day of his entry into the monastery of Sekyur at the tail of a line of novices. When it was his turn to be robed, the supply of red hats had run out. In order that he should not be hatless, someone grabbed the first hat that came to hand and put it on his head. It chanced to be a yellow one. Tsongkhapa never gave up wearing it, and so yellow came to be adopted as the color of the Reformed Church. The Dalai Lama always used to wear a yellow silk cap at receptions and ceremonies, and all the objects in regular use by him were of this color. The use of yellow was a privilege which he alone possessed. Soon we saw the god king's favorite birds being carried by in their cages. Now and then a parrot called out a welcoming word in Tibetan, which the faithful crowd received with rapturous sighs as a personal message from their god. At an interval behind the servants came monks with banners decorated with texts. Next came a band of mounted musicians wearing brightly colored, old-fashioned garb and playing old-fashioned instruments, from which they produced curious, whimpering sounds. After them followed an army of monks from the Tsedrung, also on horseback and marshaled in order of rank. Behind them, grooms led the favorite horses of the Dalai Lama, splendidly caparisoned. Their bridles were yellow and their bits and saddles of pure gold. Then came a flock of high dignitaries and senior members of the god king's household, the latter all monks with the rank of abbot. These are the only persons, except his parents and brothers and sisters, who have the right of speech with the Dalai Lama. Alongside them marched the tall figures of the bodyguard, huge fellows chosen for their size and strength. I was told that none of them is under 6 feet 6 inches in height, and one of them mere shows 8 feet. Their padded shoulders make them look even more formidable, and they carry long whips in their hands. The only sound to be heard came from them as in deep bass voices they called on the crowd to make way and take off their hats. This was obviously part of the ceremonial, as the people were already standing in dead silence with bowed heads and folded hands by the roadside. Then followed the commander-in-chief of the army. He held his sword at the salute. Compared with the silks and brocades of the other dignitaries, his khaki uniform looked strikingly modest. However, as he was free to choose the trimmings of his dress, his badge of rank and epaulettes were of pure gold. On his head he wore a sun helmet. And now approached the yellow, silk-lined palanquin of the living Buddha, gleaming like gold in the sunlight. The bearers were 36 men in green silk cloaks, wearing red plate-shaped caps. A monk was holding a huge iridescent sunshade made of peacock's feathers over the palanquin. The whole scene was a feast for the eyes, a picture revived from a long-forgotten fairy tale of the Orient. Around us, all heads were bowed in deep obeisance, and no one dared to raise his eyes. Orf Snater and I must have been noticeable with our heads only slightly bent. We absolutely had to see the Dalai Lama. And there he was, bowing to us with a smile behind the glass front of his sedan chair. His finely cut features were full of charm and dignity, but his smile was that of a boy, and we guessed that he, too, was curious to see us. The procession had passed its peak. Now came the secular authorities. The four cabinet ministers rode on splendid horses on either side of the sovereign. Behind them came another magnificent chair, carried by fewer bearers, in which sat the regent, Tagdra Gyaltsab Rimpok, styled the Tiger Rock, an old gentleman of 73. He looked sternly before him and gave no smile of greeting. He seemed not to see the people, strict and severe in the performance of his duties, he has as many enemies as friends. After him rode the representatives of the three pillars of the state, the abbots of Serra, Drebung, and Ganden. Then came the nobles in due order of rank, each group wearing the costume appropriate to its status. The junior orders wore absurd little caps that just covered their top knots and were fastened with a ribbon under their chins. Deep in contemplation of the spectacle, I suddenly heard the sound of familiar music. Yes, no mistake about it. The British National Anthem. The band of the bodyguard had taken up its station halfway along the route, and the royal chair must just have come up to them. So, to honor the God King, they played God Save the Queen. I have generally heard it better played, but it has never caused me such bewilderment. I learned later that the bandmaster had been trained in the Indian Army. He had noticed that this air played an important part at all ceremonies, so he brought the music back with him. It has been set to Tibetan words, but I have never heard them sung. The brass band finished the anthem creditably with the exception of a few wrong notes by the trumpets due to the rarefied air, and then the pipers of the police band played a selection of Scottish airs. Tibetan music knows no harmonies, but its melodies are pleasing to our ears. In the same piece they pass easily from the gloomy to the gay, and changes of rhythm are frequent. The procession vanished behind the gates of the summer palace, and the crowds dispersed, mostly to spend the rest of the day in the open air. The nomads, sweating in their warm sheepskin cloaks, strike their tents and move off to their highland homes in the Chenghthang. No Tibetan is anxious to go on a pilgrimage to India in summer, and no nomads come willingly to Lhasa in the warm weather. The capital is only 12,000 feet above sea level, and the nomads, most of whom live at 15,000 feet, find the warmth oppressive. We walked home deeply impressed by all that we had seen. We could not have witnessed a better example of the distribution of authority in Tibet than in the procession that had moved by before us, with the Dalai Lama and the regent as the high peaks, and the different grades tapered downward to front and rear. It was significant of their power in the state that the monks marched in front. Religion is the heart of the fabric of the state. Pilgrims from the remotest parts of the Chenghthang undergo countless hardships in order to come once a year and witness this brilliant manifestation of their religious faith, and they feed on the memory during their hard and lonely lives. The daily life of Tibetans is ordered by religious belief. Pious texts are constantly on their lips, prayer wheels turn without ceasing, prayer flags wave on the roofs of houses and the summits of the mountain passes, the rain, the wind, all the phenomena of nature, the lonely peaks of the snow-clad mountains, bear witness to the universal presence of the gods whose anger is manifested by the hailstorm, and whose benevolence is displayed by the fruitfulness and fertility of the land. The life of the people is regulated by the divine will, whose interpreters the lamas are. Before anything is undertaken, we must test the omens. The gods must be unceasingly entreated, placated, or thanked. Prayer lamps burned everywhere, in the house of the noble and in the tent of the nomad, the same faith has kindled them. Earthly existence is of little worth in Tibet, and death has no terrors. Men know that they will be born again and hope for a higher form of existence in the next life, earned by pious conduct in this one. The church is the highest court of appeal, and the simplest monk is respected by the people and addressed by the title of Kusho, as if he were a member of the nobility. In every family at least one of the sons is dedicated to the cloister in token of reverence for the church and to give the child a good start in life. In all these years I have never met anyone who expressed the slightest doubt about the truth of Buddha's teaching. There are, it is true, many sects, but they differ only in externals. One cannot close one's heart to the religious fervor that radiates from everyone. After a short time in the country, it was no longer possible for one thoughtlessly to kill a fly, and I have never in the presence of a Tibetan squashed an insect that bothered me. The attitude of the people in these matters is really touching. If at a picnic an ant crawls up one's clothes, it is gently picked up and set down. It is a catastrophe when a fly falls into a cup of tea. It must at all costs be saved from drowning, as it may be the reincarnation of one's dead grandmother. In winter they break the ice in the pools to save the fishes before they freeze to death, and in summer they rescue them before the pools dry up. These creatures are kept in pails or tins until they can be restored to their home waters. Meanwhile, their rescuers have done something for the good of their own souls. The more life one can save, the happier one is. I shall never forget an experience I had with my friend Wang Jula. We went one day to the only Chinese restaurant and the saw a goose running around the courtyard, apparently on its way to the cooking pot. Wang Jula quickly took a banknote of considerable value from his pocket and bought the goose from the restaurant keeper. He then had his servant carry the goose home, and for years afterward I used to see the lucky creature waddling about his place. Typical of this attitude toward all living creatures was a rescript issued in all parts of the country to persons engaged in building operations. This was during the 3 years that the young Dalai Lama spent in meditation. It was pointed out that worms and insects might easily be killed during the work of building, and the utmost care to avoid this was enjoined on all. Later on, when I was in charge of earthworks, I saw with my own eyes how the coolies used to go through each spadeful of earth and take out anything living. It follows from this principle that there is no capital punishment in Tibet. Murder is regarded as the most heinous of crimes, but the murderer is only flogged and has iron fetters forged onto his ankles. It is true that the floggings are in fact less humane than the death penalty as it is carried out in Western lands. The victim often dies an agonizing death after the penalty has been inflicted, but the religious principle has not been infringed. Criminals condemned to a life in chains are either shut up in the state prison at Sho or sent to a district governor who is responsible for their custody. Their fate is certainly preferable to that of the convicts in the prisons, who are permitted to leave their jail only on the birth and death day of the Buddha, when they may beg for alms in the Linkha, chains to fellow prisoners. Theft and various minor offenses are punished with public whipping. A board on which his offense is written is slung around the neck of the offender, and he has to stand for a few days in a sort of pillory. Here again, charitable people come and give him food and drink. When highwaymen or robbers are caught, they are usually condemned to have a hand or a foot cut off. I was horrified to see in what manner wounds so inflicted were sterilized. The limb is plunged into boiling butter and held there. Even that does not deter evildoers. A governor told me of criminals who held out their hands for punishment with an impudent gesture and after a few weeks resumed their life of crime. In Lhasa such savage forms of punishment have now been discontinued. The penalties for political offenses are very strict. people still speak of the monks of Tenailing, who 40 years ago sought to come to terms with the Chinese. Their monastery was demolished and their names blotted out. There is no organized system of law courts in Tibet. The investigation of offenses is entrusted to two or three persons of noble rank, but corruption is unfortunately very prevalent. In fact, very few nobles have a higher reputation for integrity. The sums received as bribes are regarded by many as part of the perquisites of the feudal system. If a defendant considers that he has been unjustly condemned, he is allowed to appeal to the Dalai Lama. If he is thus proved innocent, he receives a free pardon, and if not, his penalty is doubled. In Lhasa, the city magistrate officiates permanently as judge, except during the 21 days following the New Year, when all authority is exercised by the monks. The magistrate is assisted by a couple of assessors, and they are kept very busy, for, in addition to the pilgrims, many bad characters come to the capital. After the Dalai Lama had moved to his summer residence, the weather became very warm, but not unpleasantly so. At this season the day temperature never exceeds 85 degrees Fahrenheit, and the nights are cool. The air is very dry, and rain falls seldom. Soon everybody is praying for rain. There are a number of springs around Lhasa, but almost every year they dry up. When that happens, the people have to fetch their water from the river Kaichu, which runs down clear and cold from the glaciers. When the springs have ceased to flow and the barley fields are dry and withered, the government decrees that every citizen must water the streets till the order is withdrawn. At once the whole town gets busy, and everyone hurries to the river with jugs and buckets and carries the water back to the city. The nobles send their servants to fetch the water, but when they have brought it, they take a hand in pouring it on the streets and on their neighbors. There is a regular water carnival in which all participate without distinction of rank or station. Streams of water flow from the windows and roofs onto the heads of the passers-by, and it is bad form to take offense if one is wet through. The children have the time of their lives. For my part, being tall and conspicuous, I got more than my share of soaking. Everyone thought that the German Henrigler was fair game. While the water fight is going on in the street, the Oracle of Gadong, the most famous rainmaker in Tibet, is summoned to the garden of the Dalai Lama. Here are gathered together the highest officers of the government, and the Grand Lama himself presides over the ceremony. The rainmaker, a monk, soon falls into a trance. His limbs begin to move convulsively, and he gives utterance to strange groans. At that moment, one of the monastic officials begs the oracle to vouchsafe rain and thereby save the harvest. The movements of the rainmaker become more and more ecstatic, and high-pitched words escape him. A clerk takes down the message and hands it to the cabinet ministers. Meanwhile, the body of the entranced medium, now no longer possessed by the divinity, sinks unconscious to the ground and is carried out. After this performance, everyone in Lhasa excitedly waits for the rain. And rain it does. Whether one believes in miracles or looks for a logical explanation, the fact is that soon after this drama is enacted, it always does rain. The Tibetans do not doubt that the protecting deity enters the medium's body while he is in a trance, and hears and grants the prayers of the people. This explanation naturally did not satisfy me, and I tried to find a more scientific solution. I wondered if perhaps the intensive watering of the streets had caused evaporation, or if the monsoon rains had spilled over into the highlands of Tibet. The British legation had set up a meteorological station and measured the rainfall scientifically. It amounted to an average of about 14 inches a year and mostly occurred at this season. Orf Snater later installed a water gauge on the Kaich and recorded the first rise in the river level on almost the same day every year. Had he followed the rainmaker's methods, he could have instituted as a successful oracle. In former times, the rainfall in Lhasa must have been much heavier. There used to be great forests, which must have made for rainier and cooler weather. The deforestation of centuries had done its work in the provinces. Lhasa itself, with its meadows and groves of willows and poplars, was a green oasis in the treeless valley of the Kaichu. Inl Hassa we were constantly invited out and often consulted. Thus we came to know the life of the town from every angle. We had opportunities for studying the details of public administration and family life, viewpoints, manners, and morals.